From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
My name is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and you are listening to Timeless Voyager Radio. And my guest today is Dr. Arthur Melville. He is an author, a speaker, and a psychotherapist. Actually, it's kind of interesting. He is a former Mary Knoll missionary and was in Guatemala for about 6 years in an area where they, he says they don't have any roads, and I suppose they probably don't have phones and so on and so forth. Is the Bible fact or fiction? Welcome to the show, Dr. Arthur Melville.
Thank you, Bruce. Well, it sounds like an interesting article that Time has. I haven't read it myself yet, but the question, is the Bible fact or fiction? I would tend to say that it's neither. The Bible that's divided into the Old Testament and the New Testament, of course, is a compilation of many stories, myths, and teachings. And each story in the Bible itself very frequently is a composite of a number of other stories. So the Bible itself is certainly not a historic document and never can be claimed to be a historic document. The New Testament, which basically we're concerned with today in Christian America, is a number of books that were written by authors, none of whom knew Jesus personally. And the earliest one was written 70 years after his death.
Now, that's an interesting point. Now, of course, I had heard that Paul, reads and I think a lot more people know that Paul did not know Jesus, but I had no idea that what about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Yeah, they weren't the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
No, and they came afterwards, and...
Well, so who actually, I don't mean to interrupt you, and I'll let you go in a second, but if, are these other Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John people who, I mean, weren't Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the, well, okay, I'm going to stop asking you questions. Go ahead.
Okay. The writers, it's not really determined who has written each one of those books. They were accredited to men of these names, but it is frequently not believed that they were actually apostles. However, it is known that the first of the books of the New Testament was written 70 years after Jesus' death, which kind of puts it out of the realm of the apostles, who would have been pretty elderly at that point. Jesus himself, of course, never wrote anything down and never talked to anyone or never spoke to anyone or never advocated writing anything down, which is interesting. All of his teachings were verbal, and none of it was certainly dogmatic as we have made it today.
So Jesus was like, your classic, I'm going to probably step on someone, but seer, I'll say a seer.
He was absolutely a seer, and he was introducing a whole new realm into the world of that day, and it was a realm that wasn't based on an eye for an eye or battles or violence. It was certainly a whole new teaching based on love and respect for life itself, and certainly for women. And Jesus was a great proponent of respect for women, and of course that doesn't come out clearly. But as regards to is it fact or fiction, no one can claim that there is actual facts there. There are about 50 scholars that meet every year. They're Bible scholars from many, many different religions, and they come together each year to discuss the Bible and to try and actually determine from their own studies and from the studies that have preceded them on what can be actually documented that Jesus said or did, and very, very little do they claim can be documented as a statement by Jesus.
All right, so people are always trying to, usurp this whole idea by saying, you know, the Bible is the Word of God, and I believe it, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful statement, and
of course,
anyone that believes that then has their life and patterned out for them, mm-hmm. and very heavily controlled at that point.
Okay, now that, of course... I have to be very careful about this because I'm not Christian bashing. However, since we're talking about the Bible and the Bible is pretty much being propagated by Christians, I don't see how I'm going to get out of this tonight. So,
yeah, it sounds to me like you're in trouble, Bruce.
So anyway, why don't we talk a little bit about your background, and that way people can have kind of a feeling for where you're coming from.
Yeah. Well, my background, if I could sum it up, as a child, well, I grew up in a very strict Catholic family. I was one of six children, and my parents were very, very devout and very committed to the church. In fact, our life revolved around the church. So we were brought up in a very strict manner. The highest calling that any one of us could have, of course, was to become a Catholic priest or for a woman to become a nun. There were four boys in my family. Two of us did become priests. At the age of 19, I entered the seminary after 1 year of studying business at Boston College. I had determined during that 1 year that my life really wasn't going to be about business, but that I had to be making some kind of a contribution in order to make this whole thing make sense for me. So I did enter a seminary, and a missionary seminary, where I studied for 9 years in a very controlled environment. And, for example, we were only permitted to speak certain times during the day. We were never permitted to speak at any time above the first floor of a building. Our life was totally regimented: classes, prayer, meditation, study. I did that for 9 years.
What, is this Catholic?
Yeah, that's Catholic, and that's Maryknoll, which is the Catholic Foreign Mission Society
now you
of
used,
America.
Now, you use the term meditation. What type of meditation? The reason I say that is because another night this week we're going to have, of all people, Dr. Deepak Chopra will be with us, and he'll be talking about meditation and his technique.
Well, his technique is just wonderful and a very healing process and very spiritual process. We had it back in the days that I was in the seminary, and of course meditation has been around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years in this country, and not as widely used as it would be in the East or in India where Dr. Chopra is from.
But I mean,
we definitely had meditation. We would meditate. We meditated every day.
Now, the Bible uses the word meditate, doesn't it?
I'm not sure that it does. I'm a student of the Bible, but I can't say that I can remember that word being used there.
Okay, then I take it back. I thought I remembered seeing something about pray and meditate, but I might be wrong.
Well, pray is certainly there. Jesus retired to the garden and meditated, I suppose, I'm not sure that they used that word. He went into the desert for 40 days to contemplate and all. And, you know, the translation from the Aramaic into the Greek, into the Latin, into the English, a number of words can be used. So I would say, yeah, that in some form meditation is probably in there, even though I can't remember.
Why do many, many Christians think that meditation is a satanic or a bad thing to do? Do you know?
Well, it certainly isn't considered bad by any of the people I've ever associated with. In Catholicism, it's not considered bad. It's considered a tool to elevate the mind and the spirit. I would say that some people would consider it satanic, and I'm just guessing here because I haven't met people who believe that, because you can shift your consciousness through meditation, and they probably consider a shifting of the consciousness as evil in some way, because shifting the consciousness of a person can get in touch with what I would call higher levels of consciousness, different levels of consciousness, where we can come in contact with things that we would not come in contact with, sounds, for example, and energies that we would not come in contact with in our ordinary life.
What is the name of your book?
The name of my book is With Eyes to See, A Journey from Religion to Spirituality.
Wow, that's a long... Well, I'm writing this down.
The title is With Eyes to See, and the subtitle is A Journey from Religion to Spirituality.
A journey from religion
to spirituality.
What do you mean by that?
Well, religion is an institution. It's a form of dogmatic teaching and control of people. Spirituality is totally free. Spirituality is one getting in touch with one's own spirit or soul and in touch with the spirit that we call God or the energy that we call God. And religion is certainly not freeing people, but rather holds people back and controls them. Any religion does.
Now, you've used the word control 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
So this must be part of an agenda that you have.
Well, it's very, very important that we recognize that both politics and religion have the same basis in being that of controlling people.
Because, you know, we...
manipulating people and controlling them.
We spoke last night with Jordan Maxwell, who I think you know fairly well.
I know Jordan, sure.
So we talked a lot about manipulation and control through politics and religion.
Oh, very good. I didn't hear that. I'm down in Long Beach, so I didn't hear your show. But, of course, that's what religion and politics have historically done. And spirituality, though, one is free in spirituality. And to attain... God, and I really don't like using the word God because it has been so misconstrued by people. People see God as an old man with a beard or a person or something like that. And God, of course, that energy that is the precursor to all of us, that is the creator or the original energy source of which we are part, cannot fit into any of the definitions that commonly exist among us. So the word God just throws people off completely. As regards to what I'm talking about, when I talk about going back to the original source of the energy that we are.
Okay.
To do that, you have to be free.
I understand that. So let me see if I can say this. If I put words in your mouth, correct me immediately. I guess you look at religion as a possible way to become spiritual.
No, I don't. I look at religion as...
I'm wrong, all right.
...as an impediment to true spirituality.
Oh, I love that, an impediment.
I was brought up in the church, and it was devout, and as I say, I went through the 9 years of study and prayer and sacrifice, etc., and then became a priest and was assigned to the mountains of Guatemala, which you introduced. It was a wonderful, wonderful area in Guatemala where there were no roads, no electricity, no running water, and I just lived there for 6 years among... 18,000 people that were in my area, and just had the most wonderful education. But what I got in contact with there was how the church had manipulated these people who were very, very close to the earth and had a very natural religion of their own, which they were forced to leave behind when they were when they became Christians, when they were forced into Christianity.
So you really, I mean, I'm going to state it. Definitely have. Here we go again. All right. Do I detect a bad taste in your mouth when it comes to what you learned as a Catholic or as a missionary?
Not a bad taste. It would be like graduating from grammar school and having left behind kindergarten, but recognizing that you needed kindergarten to get up to the sixth grade.
Okay. So I'll come back to what I said before. For you, religion was a way to.
But I had to leave it in order
right.
to get the spirituality
right.
I'm
okay.
talking about.
All right. So
I would say that it's not a necessary ingredient for a person to become spiritual now.
That's a very important point to make because I have had periodically arguments with people who know of no other way because of what they believe. And I have known atheists who were some of the kindest and gentlest and certainly the most examples of God-fearing people I ever saw, and yet they would deny the existence of God.
I agree with you on that also, that the atheists that I know and have become acquainted with and have lectured to, in fact, are just wonderful, creative people and loving people. And not to say that the people of religion, some people aren't that also. They are. But religion is based on belief, and belief is thought that is reinforced, and to call myself, if I were to call myself a Christian, I would be saying that I was adhering to certain beliefs. The confusion is that the confusion and a major problem comes down to the people make these beliefs truth. They actually think that the belief is true, whereas we've got to go back and recognize that any thought that we have can become a belief. In Latin America, I came across people, for example, who believed that stones, that were certain particular stones, that these were gods. Now, when a child is born into the world and the child is given this idea that these stones are God, and then that idea is reinforced by authoritative figures in the child's life, the child will believe that and then actually think that it has attained some truth. I think that what we have to go back to, very, very important today, that we go back to recognizing that none of the beliefs that we hold in atheism or in religion are true. They're only beliefs.
And have nothing to do with spirituality.
Beliefs have something to do with spirituality.
Oh, they do.
But the essence of what I'm saying is that we got to recognize that they are beliefs.
So you're saying spirituality resides somewhere still in the belief system?
A belief system can reside in religion or in beliefs. It can.
Spirituality?
Yes. For example, a person can believe that God is a particular immortal being, but has not yet experienced that particular immortal being. Therefore, they have a belief. That belief can reside in either religion or spirituality.
That's very interesting.
Spirituality essentially is getting in contact with that which makes us what we are. We call it the psyche or the soul, and recognizing that, for me, recognizing that psyche or soul, that energy that is within me, that permits me to be myself and have the talents and abilities that I have, is an offshoot from the original energy that commonly we call God.
As a psychotherapist, what exactly do you do? What is your area?
Well, the area that I work in, I basically do gestalt therapy. Gestalt is a word that means to complete. What I help people to do is to complete that which has happened in their lives, that which they have been involved in, that which inhibits them from having meaningful relationships or high self-esteem or self-respect or the ability to hold down a job or to just live as a dignified human being. The work covers a pretty broad spectrum. What it comes down to is teaching a person the means or giving a person the tools to finding themselves. Most of us have lost our self-identity in childhood, and we go through life thinking that we're a communicaster on the radio or we're a psychotherapist or a lawyer or something like that, instead of recognizing the essence of who we really are as human beings. We lose it. We lose it in childhood, and we lose it basically because we are taught to inhibit or suppress our emotions. The emotions of a child frequently are not respected. We are taught not to be sad, not to be afraid, not to be angry, and thus we aren't even permitted to be joyful. So in not having the experience of oneself through the emotions, the child quickly loses its self-identity and adapts to a way of life that it is expected to by whatever system it's involved in. So when we reach a certain age, each one of us seems to find some dissatisfaction in life, and it feels like we're searching, like we're looking for more. What we're really doing is looking for ourselves. My work is helping people to find themselves so that they can lead a satisfactory and productive life. That eventually will lead a person into the spirituality.
Of course spirituality would be tied in here. As a matter of fact, I would imagine that a spiritual person would never be found with a therapist or in need of therapy.
You're probably accurate. Yeah, a person who had their own self-identity, which means that they know who they are and respect that and love that, would not be sitting in my office generally, yeah.
Do you think that religion controls people until they're ready to take responsibility for their own lives?
And a good question. I don't think so. I don't think that religion controls people until they're ready to take control of their own lives. I think that religion controls people in a manner that it is not intended that they will ever take control of their own lives.
Interesting point. I mean, what I meant by that, and perhaps, certainly you can disagree, I meant if you look at the Ten Commandments, for example, I mean, people need to be told things that would normally shouldn't have to be told. For example, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. I mean, these things seem like they would be obvious if a person was even remotely human or spiritual, and yet here are a bunch of rules for what we call these people, a bunch of, I can't even think of a word.
Well, I think that, the human being is endowed with something that's generally called the conscience, which in a normal environment helps a person to be able to evaluate between that which is good for us and that which is not good for us. And certainly the commandments are based on that which is good for us, but you don't really need the archbishop to come through and give you the Ten Commandments in order for a person to know that, God is to be honored, but the human being is to be honored also.
But people aren't taught that, certainly not in Western culture, are they?
No, I think that Western or Eastern culture, that religion basically is to, again, manipulate the populace and hold them in control and pretend that it has answers for them through which it will control them and manipulate them. but hold them for their whole lifetime. It doesn't matter whether it's Jim Jones's group or whether it's Jimmy Swaggart's group or the cult that we just have heard about in Japan or Catholicism or Mormonism. It doesn't matter what it is. Its objective is to control people and to tell them this is the way to live and this is the way to attain a reward, an after-death reward. And it's very manipulative, very controlling. And it's not the intention of any religion to release people after a time so that they attain their own spirituality.
Yeah, that's interesting because I remember interviewing Robert Monroe, who is no longer with us, who wrote some of the best, most informative books on astral travel. And I remember him telling me one time in an interview that people were just as held on to their belief system of religion when they passed over as they were before they passed over. So it's not like anybody was let go by their religion, and they could reincarnate back into that same belief system, and it would be stronger the next time.
You know, a couple of years ago, Bruce, I saw a show that was based on after-death experience, or near-death experience, excuse me. And it had three people on who had been clinically dead and claimed by medical doctors to have been dead and then have revived and came back again. And each one of them spoke about, each one of these three people that were being interviewed on the show, spoke about going into the light and having this just incredibly powerful and marvelous experience and going into the light. And so the communicaster talked to them and asked them what their experience was and what their life was like now and had it been changed. All of their lives were very drastically changed as a result of the experience. But there was one man who was a born-again Christian, very much a fundamentalist, who had all the answers and knew definitely that his specific religion was the religion that was teaching the truth. That's what he knew before he went over into this light in the near-death experience. So the person who was doing the interviewing asked him, and now, do you still hold that religion? And he said, no, at this point I hold no religion. And the person asked him then, well, why is it that you were so committed to religion before and now you have no religion? And he said, because over there I discovered that God doesn't have a religion.
I love it. I love it. Okay.
Basically, that's where I'm coming from. It's not that I have an axe to grind against Catholicism or any other religion. I really don't. It's that I was so educated in this and investigated it so deeply and looked at it from its grassroots to its highest point and all, and just found it to be, as I'm saying, a controlling, manipulative structure that does not truly serve people in a spiritual manner.
Each religion claims that only that religion, well, maybe not everyone, but almost all the religions claim that they are the only way and that the God of that religion is going to punish all the others who don't believe in their religion. This is pretty incredible stuff. I mean, that's real leverage. I've said many times, I mean, my goodness, the idea that if you don't buy into a particular religion that you're going to burn in hell for eternity is a heck of a bunch of leverage, to say the least, isn't it?
Well, some certainly claim that, and many don't, but some certainly do, and the religion that I was brought up in claimed that all the way through, and would not claim it today. The Catholic Church, as many religions, has had to open up and become much more liberal as a result of the fact that they're losing their numbers, and they're losing people in vast numbers today, people just leaving the church. And so in order to hold them, what they've had to do is expand on their traditional teaching. And, of course, the Catholic Church has done that and is continuously changing some of its teachings in order to try to hold on to people, one of them being that today people can be saved outside of the Catholic Church. But when I was involved in the church, no, it
can
wasn't
be,
that way.
Can be saved.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's quite a step.
Oh, that's a big one. But they had to do that, like the change is coming now on as regards to birth control. They threw out a lot of the old beliefs, like when I was a child and even in the seminary, we couldn't eat meat on Friday, you know? We would go to hell if we ate meat on Friday and didn't confess that as a serious sin. And I can remember when the Pope finally decided to change that because it wasn't just working in the modern world any longer with all the Big Macs sprouting up in Rome and everything. And so he said, well, we can eat meat on Friday. Well, we wanted to know what happened to all the people that went to hell for having
right, exactly.
Meat, you know?
I
can remember
it.
My mother saying when
I
the Pope
it.
Said that we could eat meat on Friday, my mother said, well, the Pope can go to hell if he wants, but I'm still not eating meat on Friday.
Now, you say that spirituality includes respect for all life. I guess we underline the word all.
Yeah.
The earth and even the spirit world.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
Well, again, if a person gets locked into that there is only God and us of any value, then they are holding a belief that will not permit them to respect animals or other forms of life. People, you were talking about someone who does astral projection. Now, that person that does astral projection has let go of a lot of beliefs that many other people hold that would not permit astral projection. In other words, a person would be tied down by their beliefs. So that man that you were talking about, Bruce, has let go of beliefs that he probably had in his childhood as regards to religion, and as a result, he is able to project astrally. He's able to go out of his body. That's a fairly common experience, but it wouldn't be accepted by a person who had a very strict, regimented religion that was controlling his or her life.
So you're basically saying, and I think I'm getting this, that religions are not only restricting, but they're actually limiting spirituality.
Absolutely. Religion, basically,
I mean, because religion is
supposed to inhibit spirituality rather than enhances it.
I mean, those people who are highly religious, I guess, are under the impression that they are spiritual.
Yeah, and I would say that I would want to acknowledge those people and any good that they bring about in their life or the lives of others. But at the same time, they are restricted by dogma, by strict rules, by clerical legislation, by, as in the Catholic Church, a hierarchy. You take the religion that I grew up in, again, Catholicism, and that I was a member of for many, many years. Today we have the problem of clerical pedophilia. And people want to know, where does this pedophilia come from? These priests are so dedicated and so religious and so holy and all. How is it they end up abusing children as they do? And I've written about this, Jordan last night might have mentioned the book that the church doesn't want you to read. Did he mention that book?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he mentioned that last night. So I have a chapter in that book on why pedophilia in the church. And it comes down to that the institution itself, which advocates and demands celibacy of its priests, is ultimately going to have a clergy that is adhering to an abnormal sexuality that is going to...
Now, abnormal, let me interrupt you. Abnormal meaning that they're being demanded of to be celibate as opposed to choosing to be celibate.
Yeah, you cannot become a priest
if
you don't agree.
Well, I mean, for example, if you and I, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the life of a householder, we'll talk about, let's say, Eastern religions, the life of a householder is one such that a person does not, certainly at that point, is not expected to be celibate. Mm-hmm. The life of a recluse is expected to be celibate, and a person usually makes that decision on their own and is not forcing themselves to do something that they don't want to do. And as a result, usually that type of celibacy works very well.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about is that a person has to move from being the life of a householder to the life of a recluse without any precursor to the event.
Well, it's...
I mean, some people are ready, aren't they?
Yeah, well, celibacy is wonderful.
But some people
celibacy
are...
Celibacy is wonderful for those who have prepared for it and are ready for it. But many celibates are hiding from relationship, or they're hiding from their sexuality, or they're hiding from their fears of closeness or intimacy or something like that. That's no reason to proclaim oneself as a celibate and then be honored by people, as the Catholic Church would be for being celibate. In my experience in the seminary was that many of us there were hiding from sexuality and for hiding from relationships with women.
So, and you're saying that it comes out as pedophiles?
Ultimately, it comes out as a sickness.
That can be the result, okay.
Yeah, just as there's a high incidence of alcoholism among Catholic priests. And again, I think that results is the frustration that one experiences in the celibate life. And alcohol, of course, lowers the inhibitions, and if a person was oriented towards pedophilia, the alcohol certainly would help that along also.
So, It's not funny, but in a way, it's kind of interesting to look at it from that point. Here, you feel you're secure in this big religious vacuum, and yet we find that a lot of abuse was occurring there, and that it was almost as bad as being on the outside, sometimes worse.
Worse, because the life of the celibate priest will that is a life of honor and respect and power that the members of the church give to this priest. The life of that celibate priest is one that will attract people who already have psychological problems. They will not be detected during the seminary years. When that priest is out in a parish or working in a school surrounding and all, if indeed his weakness is towards children, if his phobia or whatever leads him into that area, yeah, he is free to practice it, because the control that he has on people and the respect that they give him. We talked about is the Bible fact or fiction. We talked about beliefs.
Yeah, we're going to come back and talk about that Bible again, too.
Mm-hmm. I would like to say, as regards to beliefs, again, this is fundamental for me, is that all of us get in touch with what our beliefs actually are and recognize that they are thoughts that have been reinforced frequently by others in us. One thing that I did, Bruce, when I started getting some insight into what I was doing in religion, was I began to list all the beliefs that I held. And I made a long, long, long list of my beliefs. And then I went back over them, and I determined what was the source of each one of those beliefs.
That's pretty incredible.
Many of them had come from my grandmother or my parents or the church.
So people need to understand that they are not born with beliefs, because I think they forget that.
We not only forget that we're not born with them, we forget that they are not truth. If we had truth, we would not have belief. Truth is further on than belief. For example, I might say to someone, is my wife in the next room? And they would say, well, I don't know whether she's in the next room. And I would say, well, she is in the next room. Let me tell you clearly that she is in the next room. And I say to them, so now is my wife in the next room? And they would say, well, I believe that she is. So they now have a belief based on what I said to them, that she's in the next room. And I would say, well, now go into the next room and check and see if she's there. So they go into the next room and they come back and they say, she's there. And I say, so do you believe that she's there? And they say, no, I don't believe that she's there. I know that she's there.
So this is the difference between belief and truth.
Yeah, that we want to, the truth is actually the experience. And beliefs are very, very important. All of us have them. Our lives are run and based on them. But we want to know what our beliefs are, where they came from, do they truly serve us, and do we want them?
Now, where is faith in this thing?
Well, faith is, all of us have faith. For example, those who believe that going into Bosnia-Herzegovina with our troops, believe that that's a good thing, are into a belief. And they have faith, therefore, in President Clinton, who is saying that it is a good thing and offering all kinds of reasons for the troops going there. Someone else says, no, it's not a good thing. And they say, well, Newt Gingrich said such and such, and so-and-so said such. And they've never been to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and they have no idea what this war is about over there.
So no one has the truth, though, do they?
So no one has the truth, but we all have our beliefs. Now, each one of us would have a belief around that, I would imagine, or else we have indifference, which isn't too healthy. But so we do have belief, but we want to recognize that none of us have the truth about Bosnia-Herzegovina. None of us.
So those people who purport to know the truth,
including Bill Clinton and...
Right,
and
are actually just blowing smoke, aren't they?
They're trying to gather facts, but in the gathering of facts, what they're doing is believing what their advisors are saying to them, what their military attachés are saying to them, what people from Bosnia-Herzegovina are telling them, what they're hearing from the Muslims or the Christians, etc. And then they put together their belief, and they are operating from belief and thinking that they have truth.
So could I say that truth is found in spirituality and belief is found in religion?
Well, hopefully. There may be some truth in religion, and probably is, but basically it's beliefs. In spirituality, there may be some beliefs also, but it basically comes down to one's own experience, that spirituality is getting in touch with one's own spirit or psyche or soul, and getting in touch with the energy that it is and the power that it holds and the connection that it has to other spirits or other people or other levels of consciousness, which would be other spirits, and ultimately hopefully the energy that started this whole thing off, the original source that people refer to as God.
You spent a great deal of time in Guatemala as a missionary.
Mm-hmm.
And were you a priest at that point?
Definitely. Oh, yeah. Okay. I was ordained a Catholic priest. So
that
was assigned. Yeah, as I said, I went 9 years into the seminary preparing for the priesthood. Then I was ordained and then assigned to Guatemala.
Now, you had to have come face-to-face with shamanism and the spiritual world, and certainly would have at that point started to have questions about your own religion. I guess that would have had to be where it happened. Is that correct?
Well, I was definitely interested in all forms of belief and practices and very interested in shamanism. And shamanism calls the attention of a person like myself in Guatemala because they are involved with healings of people and also calling down of evil upon people. And so that very, very much interested me. How was this all coming about? And as I was to find out in my investigation, in my conversations with shamans, was that it's, again, based on belief, that if you, Bruce, were to believe that a shaman had certain powers, and then you went to this shaman and did whatever you had to do, either pay him or go through whatever rites he required you to go through, you would have a firm belief that you were going to get the outcome that you had gone searching for. You very frequently would create that outcome out of your own powers, your own spiritual, psychic, or physiological powers that each one of us has. So these people were really bringing about healings, and the people believed that they were also calling down evil upon enemies, and it was basically the belief of the people, and people believing in the shamans and giving that power over to the shamans that brought about the results that they were bringing about. When you said that you're going to have Deepak Chopra on one of these nights, Dr. Chopra on your show, and he will be talking about people believing in themselves and believing in their ability to heal. And he, of course, is a medical doctor, and he will, I'm sure, explain how most people have a belief in their medical doctor, that the medical doctor can bring about healing. Therefore, they go to the medical doctor and get healing that they possibly have brought about themselves, but a credit to the medical doctor. And he will talk about the belief, if a person does believe that they can actually heal themselves, that we have great powers locked up within us to bring about physical and spiritual and psychological mental healings within ourselves, if we only can overcome the beliefs that we don't have those. So when I was in Guatemala, I met shamans who believed that they were representatives of God on earth, just as the Catholic priest believes that he is a representative of God on earth, and that they have been privileged, this is their belief, that they have been privileged to participate in that divine energy to the extent that they can heal people as well as call down evil upon those who need that. And my first introduction to it was I was...
Now, that would be the main difference, I guess, between the church and the shaman or shaman. I mean, at least from what we understand, at least the priest doesn't call down evil on people. Or at least that's
He can. Of course, the priest has a similar power in the Catholic Church, in that he can forgive sins or not forgive them. And if he doesn't forgive them, you're going to hell.
Are you serious? The priest actually can exercise the idea of not forgiving a sin?
Absolutely.
I'm shocked.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, folks, 1-800-433-0030. If you can get through, here's one for you.
But
I didn't know that. I always thought you went to confession, and then he said everything was fine and left.
Well, yeah. If the priest believes that you are repentant and that you deserve absolution, then he will give you absolution, which is the forgiveness of sin. If he doesn't believe, and again, we're dealing with belief. If he doesn't believe that you are repentant, sufficiently repentant, he will not give you absolution.
Now, of course, absolution happens inside the psyche of the person, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it comes through the power of the priest. That's the belief.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The belief is such...
That the priest forgives, and then the person walks away, having altered their psyche, and they feel much better coming out of confession.
Well, I'm sure it works, because if you give that power to the priest, then that would be your choice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All based on belief.
And belief, we need to probably start sifting through this. Belief is giving your power to something, your personal power to manifest, or to certainly to manifest, is part of what belief is about.
Yes. Yeah, an example. People in Guatemala, many people in Guatemala, as in many countries, believe that the shaman can call down the evil. So let's say that you and I both believe, Bruce, that the shaman can call down the evil, and you consider me your enemy. So you go to the shaman and do whatever you have to do, pay him or bring him food or go through whatever procedures you have to go through, and he calls down the evil on you, and then word gets back to me that the shaman has called down the evil on me. I very frequently will get sick because of my belief that he has called down the evil. Now, I am creating the sickness in myself from that belief that he has the power to call down the evil and has done that. And it does happen.
Now, so then do you go to another shaman, pay him to undo it or
yeah,
block it?
That's
so these guys are making money.
That's part of the game. That's part of the game. But, you know, it works.
Of course it works.
And the calling down of the evil, I went to this particular shaman. One day I had asked to be invited to his house. I had extracted one of his teeth. I was sort of the dentist and doctor and did set up medical clinics and things like that. And
boy, that's a stretch. You actually extract. Now, of course, I don't want to say anything about this. Did you really know how to do that?
Oh, yeah. I had studied that in
the
States here before I went down.
I didn't know.
Yeah. My work was...
I'm imagining you standing there and say, sure, I'm a dentist.
Well, I didn't fill any
teeth. What do they know?
I didn't do any root canals or fill any teeth. But,
wow.
But I extracted teeth, which they had no way to get these teeth out that were infected and were causing horrible...
I'll tell you what. My spine is tingling right now with the fear.
I extracted thousands of teeth down there.
Oh, I don't want to.
I would inject with Novocaine.
Oh, well, that's one thing.
Yeah, and then had all the tools that were required for the extraction of teeth and knew very, very well how to do it.
What else did you do down there?
We set up, in my parish, we set up a birth control clinic.
Huh.
Yeah, we took the parochial school and turned it into a public school.
Now, why did you do that?
Believing that we really needed public education and not further indoctrination of the children.
Very interesting.
We needed people to work together. What we were working for, I and the nuns who were working with me, who also were Americans, what we wanted was a community, people who were cooperating, not people who were being turned against each other, one being right, the other being wrong. And so we weren't going to push the beliefs upon the next generation of school children, but rather we were going to give them example as to how we were living, and therefore we were going into the public schools and teaching, and rather than have the Catholic school, which is a beautiful, wonderful, the most beautiful building in all the area surrounding us, we turned that into a public school and had public school teachers there and actually facilitated further education.
Now,
I
interrupted you when you were talking about the shaman, so let's
get
back.
I went to see the shaman. I extracted his tooth. That's how I met him. He came to me in great pain, which was quite humiliating for him, because here's the great healer coming to the Catholic priest, who is considered his enemy because the church has suppressed all the shamans and actually, you know, treated them very, very poorly. And he came to me and asked me to extract his tooth, which I did. And while he was there, I said, can I come and visit you? And so I went to his little ranchito one day, and we sat and talked. And sitting out on a little patio was this cross. Now, the cross preceded Christianity, of course, in that it was the sign of the four directions or the four winds. And he had a cross out there in front of him. And he told me that that cross had all kinds of power, and that power came...
Let's slow down for a second. Let's repeat that now for people who may have just tuned in and did not hear what you just said about the cross. Say it once more now. It preceded...
Well, the cross was in the Americas long before Columbus came with the troops and with the priests and all bringing Christianity or Catholicism to the Americas. The indigenous people had the cross here, as they did in the United States. The American Indians did also. And it was a symbol of the four directions or the four winds, which was very spiritual for them. The four directions was taking them out to the all that is or the original source or the great father in the sky. And so this man had a cross in front of his house, which many people would think was a Christian symbol when they saw it. Actually, to him, it was more from his native religion that existed before Christianity. And we sat there talking about the cross, and he told me that the cross was to be respected, and anyone who would in any way disrespect the cross, the evil would be called down upon them. And we got into this discussion around calling down evil and then from there into healing. And I told him that from my perspective, from my knowledge of humanity, that and my my own personal experience was that people's beliefs were very, very important, and those that believed that the evil could be called down upon them would create the evil themselves in their own lives, and those that believed that they could actually be healed by certain procedures were healing themselves, but it was the belief that they could be healed that was permitting them to do that. And he said to me, no, it wasn't that way at all, that he was a shaman, in other words, a representative of God on the earth, and he had the power to call down the evil as well as to heal people. So this went back and forth and back and forth. And he said to me this thing about the cross, and I said to him, well, what would happen if someone took down the cross? And he said, if someone took down the cross, then they would have to suffer the retribution of the cross. This is quite an interesting story that I do tell in the book, Bruce. But just to sum it up, I said to him, well, you know, this is in conflict with where I come from. And he said, well, let me call down the evil on you, and let me show you that this is a reality, that this actually works. He says, you don't believe in this, do you? And I said, no. And he said, well, let me demonstrate to you that it works. So I started shaking in my boots because my beliefs were not that strong. I had never confronted my beliefs this way before. This man was going to call down evil upon me, which might mean an illness, it might mean my death, it might mean an accident or anything like that. But I stood by what I did believe, and he said, can I call down the evil on you? And I said, well, gee, I've got to stand by what I've said here, you know. Do I believe this or not? And I said, okay. I said, you can call down your evil on me. And he said, fine. And I said, but wait, under one condition. And he said, what's the condition? And I said, that I can cut down your cross. And so here he's up against his belief, you know, that if the cross is cut down, the retribution
of the cross is going to... This is interesting.
We made an agreement that I could cut down his cross and that he could call down the evil on me. And it was just this fantastic, surreal episode that unfolds here, whereby he goes and gets me this big machete and I go out and stand in front of his cross and chop the thing down. And he sits there sweating, watching me doing it. Because this had never
happened. And, of course, you're sweating, wondering if you're going to get...
I was soaking and I was scared also. And then I chopped down the cross, and I picked it up, and I brought it to him, and I set it down before him. His name was Virgilio, which is Virgil in English. And I said, so Virgil, does the cross still have power? And he said, I believe that it still has power. You really don't know what you've done here. And he said, but now it's my turn. He said, now I call down the evil. I said, how much time do you need to call down the evil on me? And he said, I need 30 days to do it.
Wow, that's a lot longer than it was
to
cut down the cross.
But as I rode my mule through the mountains, did all the things I did that month, I remained very much aware of the fact that this man was doing everything he could, making all kinds of animal sacrifices and incantations and other things to call down his evil on me, and that I had to remain healthy and alive during this time. And at the end of the 30 days, he came to me just to acknowledge that his belief... that I didn't share his belief, and therefore he couldn't do it. That only with the people that believed that he could do it could he actually call down the evil. Nothing befell me. I didn't even get the sniffles that month.
Hmm. And what about the...
The cross?
The cross, yeah.
He put it back up again.
Hmm.
He just put it back up again and went on with his life, and probably very few people ever knew that ever happened.
The point was that here you have essentially proved what you started out by saying when we started the show.
Yeah, if you believe it, it will have a very, whatever you believe will have a very powerful influence on your life. If you believe that you're a sinner, then you're going to lead a very sad life.
Hmm.
If you have a contrary belief, for example, that you're not, if you have, for example, the belief that you are a child of God and that you are here to actually flourish and progress, then you have quite a different life than the person who is hanging out in the belief of sin. So this man believed that he could call down the evil. He could call down the evil would apparently be called down on a person who believed that he could do it, but it would actually be the person themselves that was creating the so-called evil in their life, whether it was sickness or accident or whatever it was.
That's why I was saying that the person who believes that the priest can give them absolution...
Absolutely.
...gets absolution.
They get it. They feel great.
And they're also the ones who would feel pretty bad if the priest said he wasn't going to forgive them.
Yes, definitely.
That's a very, very incredible story.
And when the priest himself believes that he can forgive sin, my goodness, what a position he is in. What a powerful, manipulative position he is in. When he believes that he can bring down Jesus Christ, God and man, soul and divinity, onto the altar through bread and wine, and actually believes that he can truly do that, and the people in his congregation believe that he can do that, he has tremendous power now. He can actually bring God down to them. Well, the spirit world is a reality. It does actually exist. And a person will be involved with, communicate with, or experience the spirit world according to the beliefs that they hold. If a person holds the belief that there is no spirit world, then there's not a chance of them getting in contact with it or benefiting from it, of course.
What does the Bible actually say about the spirit world? Does it say anything?
Well, of course, many times throughout it, they're speaking of angels. Angels are disembodied beings, spirits.
Angels are disembodied. Now, when you say disembodied, okay, disembodied means they do not have a carnal or a third-dimensional body.
Right, right.
But disembodied,
and yet they are a reality.
Disembodied does not mean that they have not incarnated, or that they have incarnated and no longer have a body.
Well, I guess
it can be any of those.
I guess we could use it either way.
But you use the word
they're non-corporeal. The beings that are referred to as angels in Catholicism, and I suppose in many aspects of Christianity, there are seven levels of angels, starting with the archangels and coming down to the seraphim and the cherubim. And supposedly the archangels, there are four archangels who are the first step down from the original source or the creator God. And then we come down to levels of angels. And then under the angels, under the seven levels of angels, there would be other spirit beings. And among those would be human beings who are no longer in their body, who have passed on, who have died, and yet their spirit still exists and still is an individual entity with its own consciousness and its own intelligence, and they definitely still exist. Now, a person can actually get in touch with them, as many people in Guatemala do, because they have no problem with the belief around the spirit world.
Yeah, now I just want to interrupt and throw something in. I remember I did a show one time where it was brought up that we on this side are the ones who separate. In other words, we're the ones that made the belief system that we can't see them or hear them or talk to them. They, of course, don't feel that way, but they can't communicate it with us if we won't communicate with them.
Normally not. If we're closed down, if our beliefs close us down, we will not be, our space will not be violated. They will not invade and force us into any kind of an experience with them. No, that's normally the way that it works. I was going to say that the people in, well, for example, all of us have a dream life. You know, each night we go to sleep, and it's been demonstrated that most of us will have nine complete dreams in an evening, in an 8-hour sleep. And yet most people will not be aware of their dreams when they wake up in the morning. That doesn't mean that the dream doesn't exist because the people are not aware of it. People can get aware of their dreams and can recall many of them and bring them back and can actually use them too. Dreams are another reality other than this waking reality. And yet if we hold on to the belief that the only reality that exists is our waking, earth-conscious reality, then we can't go beyond here. If we do start going into our dream life, though, we're starting to shift the consciousness. We're starting to go into another reality, actually, and it opens up spaces for us to go much further. The process of going further into the spiritual life is unlimited. Where it goes it depends upon the individual and how far they're willing to go with it. But as I was saying, in Guatemala, people actually see spirits and experience them and talk to their deceased.
Now, do they call themselves mediums, or do they? I mean, what?
Seems that they're virtually all mediums. I remember when I first went to...
You're saying the average person...
Average person is in touch with their deceased members of their family down there.
Okay.
That's just... no one's ever taught them not to do that.
And again, you said something very important in the beginning of the show. All the beliefs that we have were taught to us. We were not born with any of them.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right, and all a belief is a reinforced thought. So any thought that I have, if it's reinforced sufficiently by myself or by an authoritative figure, it becomes a belief. The confusion is when I think that belief is truth instead of recognize it as simply a reinforced thought.
Now, the Catholic Church has always made room for mediums, hasn't it?
In what way?
Well, in the way that maybe the mediums were not necessarily recognized, but I've always noticed that most mediums who were Catholic were highly spiritual.
Okay. Yeah, there is room in Catholicism, but it's very limited space. So if the average person starts coming up with it, they may start talking about the devil rather than about... And the devil in the Catholic Church, of course, is considered an evil spirit.
Now, of course, and we have to understand that the spirit world has both.
Well, I've never, since I've become involved in it myself, I have never experienced any evil in the spirit world. And I again think that it depends upon a person's belief.
Yeah, now...
If a person believes that there is evil, mm-hmm. that there are evil spirits around them, then, you know, they will begin to experience the result of their belief. I myself have no experience of evil, and all the people that I've been working with in the past 30 years who have had spiritual experiences and all, never once have I got in contact with anything evil or bad or destructive.
Okay, and
that's
and,
my own experience, and therefore my own beliefs. I remember in Guatemala.
Well, if you're
going
to have a belief,
once,
that's a good one to have, isn't it?
You know, once we become aware that our life is going to follow the channel of our beliefs, it's good to have positive, healthy, working beliefs.
I remember one time someone asked me what I believed, and I said, well, I'll tell you what I believe, and this is true. I believe that, first of all, I don't die, I just change form.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe that everything that I do is okay, mm-hmm. unless it harms someone else. And even in that case, the problem is me deciding what is harm and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part I told them I believe is I believe I'm going to have a wonderful time. Both places.
Yeah, now imagine if you didn't believe that you were going to have a wonderful time, what you'd be creating in your life.
Exactly. So, I mean, I'm having a great time on both sides, and I don't put emphasis on one side as being better than another. And I think, you know, if I don't want to go off on this tangent, but I think that if there's any manipulation at all in a lot of the religions, one of the things that they do is they try to purport the other side, the heaven experience, or the experience of not being carnal, as being somewhat better than this.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's necessarily true or not.
Well,
I mean, I'm sure that there are just, I mean, I've always been told there are just as many people who want to incarnate as there are people who think that it's better on the other side.
Well, it's not like we're dissociated. We're all in this together, whether we're in the spirit world or whether we're in a physical body and have a spirit within us. We're all in this together, and we're all from that original source, that original energy source. Energy cannot be destroyed. You are an energy being. I am an energy being. If there is an angel in the room there with you, Bruce, and there probably is, that is an energy being, but we're all participating. We all have the same root. It's not like we are distinct from each other. We can relate to each other. We can communicate with each other.
Wasn't it L. Ron Hubbard who said that we are all spiritual beings learning to be human, as opposed to human beings trying to learn to be spiritual?
Possibly. I've never read L. Ron Hubbard myself.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that. But
anyway, whoever said that, I think, was saying basically what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You're spiritual.
Yeah.
Trying to learn how to be human.
Yeah. Now, a belief that I hold that comes into reality for me all the time is I believe that any person can heal themselves of any sickness, of any illness, of any disease. I also believe that any human being can create in themselves any sickness or disease. And so...
And that's good, as long as you can believe that. Now, see, unfortunately, a lot of people don't believe that. They don't.
You know, I heard someone give a lecture recently, and this woman was giving the lecture, and she stood up at the podium and looked out at the audience, then looked down at her notes, then took out her glasses, and she said, over 40, you know, and put on her glasses. And virtually everyone shook their heads, realizing that over 40 you have to wear glasses. I don't adhere to that belief. I wore glasses when I was 21 years old and had pretty heavy glasses till I got in touch with this belief at about the age of 28. I'm now 62 and don't wear glasses. I can see at night fine, I can see distance fine, I can see up close fine, but I believe that I am forming my own eyesight and not giving that power over to an ophthalmologist or an oculist.
I like
and
that.
And that belief is very much influencing. I know that if I didn't have that belief, I would still be wearing heavy glasses as I did at 21.
Well, I asked somebody once in the middle of a major viral infection that was going around Southern California. I said, I noticed you're very healthy. And the guy looked at me and he said, yeah, he says, I don't buy into this stuff that you can catch a cold.
Interesting.
You know, and it was interesting because as long as I've known him, he has done many things and never wears a jacket, always goes out in the rain, gets wet. He's never sick. And I thought to myself, I mean, that's not the only thing about him, but that was something that I found interesting.
Yeah.
And he used to say to me over and over again, that doesn't make you sick.
Interesting.
And so it didn't make him sick. Do you communicate with spirit world.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's now let me ask you this, because I think if there were any calls that could have gotten through tonight, I'm sure someone would have asked this question. So let me ask it.
Mm-hmm.
What religion are you now?
I don't have a religion.
Great. I'm glad that we finally.
But if I am like the man who had the near-death experience, went to the other side, saw the light, and who had been a fundamentalist Christian, came back without any religion. When asked, why don't you have a religion? He said, because on the other side, I found out that God doesn't have a religion.
So you're not a recovered Catholic.
all religion, of course, is, quote, man, unquote, made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the divine or the spirit comes to us through our goodwill. We can go directly to it. We can enjoy it. We can participate in its energy, its healing energy, its loving energy. And to go through a religion, which is a structure, a dogmatic structure, which is based on control and, if you would, manipulation, does not lead us necessarily to that spirit or to the enjoyment of the presence of that spirit.
We've been talking about belief and faith and truth and spirituality, and we need to wrap this thing up now and actually have it make sense.
Well, I think that a good place for us to conclude is where everybody is, where most people are today, which is searching. People are definitely searching. Many people are searching out and further than their religions, beyond their religions, or more deeply into their religions. So I think maybe we could conclude by saying that what we're really searching for is ourselves, our self-identity, our participation in the God life, if you would. And I think that an approach to that that would work for all of us is not to go out and try and make contact with the angels or try and communicate with our deceased relatives, although you may choose to do that. But a very practical way to do it is to bring truth into our own lives, to be committed to the truth. And the truth, of course, as we've been saying, is experience. And the experience that we have of ourselves is emotional. I know myself, my experience of myself, through my emotions, not through my thoughts, not necessarily through my behavior. So the emotions are sourced from the soul being the psyche. I am a psychotherapist, as Bruce has said. That means I do therapy in a psychic or with the psyche. The psyche is simply a Greek word, which means soul. Soul is that part of us that we call the spirit. The spirit sources the emotions in us, so the emotions become very, very important once we realize that. Now, as children, we were taught not to experience our emotions. We were taught that if we were good, we should not be afraid, we should not be sad, we should not be angry, we should simply be happy. Well, all of those emotions, those are the four basic emotions that I just mentioned there. Each of those emotions is an energy that runs through the body at any given moment, and it is a frequency. Each emotion is a frequency of its own, and it runs through this electromagnetic system that each of us has. What we want to do is get in touch with those emotions, with the experience of them, and to accept the experience of our emotions as an experience that we ourselves have created, and not to make that experience bad or wrong, but rather to accept it, to embrace it, and to communicate it to others appropriately. And that is our first step in truth, and that is the first step in getting in touch with who we are, with regaining our self-identity, which puts us on a path towards further spiritual development.
Very well said. I'll tell you, I'm very, very excited with this evening's show. I learned a lot. I feel like I know our listeners certainly did. And hopefully the next time we do a show together, which will be soon, we'll have these phones organized so that people can talk directly to you. Dr. Arthur Melville, thanks so much for being with us here this evening.
Thank you, Bruce. It's certainly been a pleasure for me.
All right. And the rest of you, all I want to say is, keep listening to Timeless Voyager Radio. Tell your friends about it. Tell your friends what a great time you had this evening. Certainly the idea is to open up belief systems, to perhaps open up that box that we tend to live in so long, and allow ourselves to start experiencing more than just what we've been told. One of the most important things that was said this evening was that beliefs are thoughts. They are things that have been taught to you over and over again. You're not born with your beliefs. So don't be afraid to look at those beliefs and to perhaps explore them. Thank you.